Journalists under threat, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Yesterday's mass shooting in Annapolis, Maryland, targeted a local newspaper. And someone who monitors attacks against journalists around the globe sees something familiar.
I see certain parallels that resonate with me and are kind of sadly typical of the kinds of attacks we see in many other parts of the world.
Also, Vice President Mike Pence tells Central American leaders to do more to stop the exodus of migrants heading to the U.S.
I reject the idea or disagree with the Vice President in claiming that these families are not fleeing insecurity and violence and that they're just trying to game the system.
Plus, the Men's World Cup heads into the knockout stages. That's all coming up today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. We often cover the murder of journalists in other countries who are being targeted and silenced for the work they do. Today, we're mourning five people killed in a newsroom here in the U.S. Gerald Fishman, Robert Hyacin, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith, Wendy Winters, all killed in the attack yesterday at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland. The suspect, Jared Ramos, had a history with the community paper. He allegedly used social media to harass Capital Gazette journalists online, and a few years ago, he unsuccessfully sued the paper for defamation. All of this might be why officials are calling this a targeted attack. Joel Simon is the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel, your organization tracks attacks against journalists in the U.S. and around the world. Can you put the Capital Gazette incident in context for us in terms of attacks against journalists in this country?
Well, in terms of attacks in the United States, yesterday was the most deadly day that we've ever recorded and perhaps in U.S. history. However, it's worth noting that violence against journalists in the United States is in no way unprecedented. In fact, there are incidents fairly frequently.
A tricky thing about the tragedy in Annapolis is that it seems pretty clear that Jared Ramos is a troubled man who likely has emotional or mental health issues. Does that put this particular case in a different category?
Well, I think we don't really know that much about him or his motivations. We just have sort of skeletal information. We know that he seemed to have an obsession with the newspaper and its coverage and tried to sue them and threaten them. But I do want to make another point that's really about the role of journalists within their own communities. And this is about something we see around the world, which is that local journalists covering their own communities tend to be very vulnerable. And there are a couple reasons for this, we believe. One is that there's an intimacy. The people they cover actually know the journalists and interact with them. The second is that the coverage within their own communities can really affect the way these aggrieved individuals are perceived. So around the world, we do notice that local journalists working in their own communities, covering activities in their own communities, whether around crime or human rights or whatever it might be, they're some of the most vulnerable journalists, and this terrible shooting conforms to that pattern which we've seen globally.
I'm curious, in the cases you follow globally, have you had incidents like this where someone's kind of acting out on social media, they seem troubled, and they go after a journalist? I ask it because often we hear about, say, in Mexico, lots of journalists have been murdered, and they seem to be targeted around things that the journalist is covering. And whether it's narco traffickers or whatever, this seems qualitatively different from many international cases of journalists being killed. And I just wonder if you can talk about those nuances.
I think it's very difficult to fully understand the mental state of this individual. But there are certain similarities that we have to acknowledge. One is that he was covered in this newspaper wrote about a criminal conviction against him. He was upset about that. He tried to pursue some sort of legal redress, which was ineffective. He threatened the newspaper, and now he's alleged to have carried out this terrible attack. And around the world, we see that news organizations and individual journalists who are attacked are often threatened first. The people who attack them for whatever reason feel they have some sort of legitimate grievance. I see certain parallels that resonate with me and are kind of sadly typical of the kinds of attacks we see in many other parts of the world.
Your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, does a lot of work focusing on journalists attacked and killed in other countries. Are you are you surprised to find you're dealing with these situations here in the U.S.?
Well, I am surprised to be dealing with this horrible situation, which really puts the U.S., you know, among the most deadly countries in the world this year. I mean, it's an anomaly, but keep in mind that it's right now the third most deadly country. Afghanistan, 10 journalists have been killed. Syria, 5 journalists have been killed. And next is the United States. So I'm very surprised to find myself in this position. At the same time, there are a number of very significant press freedom concerns outside of violent attacks. We certainly know about the alarming rhetoric coming from our political leaders, including President Trump. There have been, as I mentioned, journalists attacked and covering protests and journalists arrested as well. And we're very concerned about the threat of legal action and possible subpoenas. So I don't think these things are necessarily related, but you put them all together and you have to recognize that, you know, people think because we have the First Amendment, we live in some free expression paradise, but clearly that's not the case.
Joel Simon, he's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Uncertainty continues this week over efforts to reunite those children separated from their parents after crossing the U.S.'s southern border. The families were caught up in the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy for undocumented immigrants. Many of those families have been coming from Central America. And yesterday, Vice President Mike Pence traveled to Guatemala to meet with that country's president, Jimmy Morales, as well as the presidents of El Salvador and Honduras. Pence had some pretty harsh words for all three of them.
President Donald Trump sent me here today because the United States faces another crisis on our southern border. And I'm sad to report to the presidents gathered here that the vast majority of those entering our country illegally are from your countries. Most are making the journey seeking economic opportunity, driven by the misguided belief that they can ignore the laws of the United States and enter our nation without consequences. I say with great respect to the presidents gathered here, this exodus must end.
Here to parse Pence's message is Adriana Beltran. She's an expert in Central American security issues at the Washington Office on Latin America. Adriana, what's your reaction to Vice President Pence's comments?
It's really unfortunate that absent from the discussion was talk of the drivers of migration. Vice President Pence's remarks focused on trying to press the Central American leaders to tighten their borders, to take extra security measures to arrest coyotes, and doesn't really focus on what is driving many families and children and women to flee their homes in the first place. I reject the idea or disagree with the vice president in claiming that these families are not fleeing insecurity and violence and that they're just trying to gain the system.
What do you see as the main drivers of the migration from these countries?
Primarily, I would say that many children, many women, and many families are fleeing epidemic levels of violence and insecurity. While we have seen a reduction in the overall levels of violence, these three countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, continue to remain among the most violent in the world.
What's behind the violence?
There are many factors behind this violence. A lot of it is driven by organized crime that has gained control of swaths of territory in these three countries. Much of the violence is also perpetrated by street gangs that, in essence, you know, place curfews, set the rules in these communities, and that extort many small businesses. You also have countries that have extremely weak institutions and are confronting endemic levels of corruption.
So what you're saying is things like the legal institutions, et cetera, police, these institutions themselves are corrupt, and therefore crimes that are committed simply aren't being addressed or investigated.
Right. You're talking about institutions that continue to be extremely weak and therefore are not able to address the needs of the population. And a lot of it, again, has to do with the corruption, because it's corruption that has enabled these criminal networks to thrive and to co-opt state institutions. And therefore, you have institutions that essentially, when they work to protect the interest of a few.
But what can the presidents of these countries do? Do they have any power to change those institutions? What is needed for change or reform to make these institutions more vigorous?
On the one hand, I would say a strong, unwavering commitment to combat corruption. In the case of Guatemala, for instance, for the last 10 years, you've had the presence there of a UN-led commission called the Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala that works hand in hand with the local prosecutor's office. They have achieved great success, not only in trying to unearth this corruption networks that have co-opted the state, but have tried to improve and strengthen the capacities, investigative capacities of the local institutions. What you see right now in Guatemala, in the case of Guatemala, is a fierce backlash campaign that has been led by the president, by members of Congress, and by his allies that are trying to undermine this anti-corruption fight and essentially bring these cases and the reform agenda to a halt.
Adriana, what can the U.S. do to address the problems in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras?
Well, I think, these are long-term challenges that are going to require a long-term agenda. I think, the U.S. Has been providing assistance, although the Trump administration has called for significant cuts in international aid, some of which supports good initiatives like the ones I mentioned. I think we ought to continue that. I think we ought to look at investing and supporting good initiatives. But I think the message also needs to be to the governments that, they need to support and commit to advancing needed reforms. You're not going to see advances in addressing these challenges unless you have the commitment on the part of the Central American governments as well.
Do you think we're facing a crisis on our southern border? I mean, is the number of people crossing illegally into the U.S. simply going up and up?
I think we're facing a humanitarian crisis. I think the U.S. has laws in place to be able to handle asylum requests in an orderly fashion and following due process. So I don't think, it's the crisis that the administration is making it out to be. I think there are things that we can do to ensure that those families and children that are fleeing very dangerous situations and have legitimate claims to asylum are able to go through that process.
Adriana Beltran is a Central American expert at the Washington Office on Latin America. Thanks a lot, Adriana.
Thank you.
A quick update now on Mexico's national elections coming up on Sunday. Most eyes are on the presidential race, but there are also hundreds of races for seats in Mexico's Congress. One issue that's very much on voters' minds, record levels of violence in the country. And a new report this week shows just how much violence has been a part of the campaign itself. It says that more than 130 politicians have been murdered over the course of the campaign. Will Grant is on the story for the BBC in Mexico City.
So it is obviously part of the wider drug war, but clearly this is political violence. This is targeting politicians because they're politicians, pushing into the political spaces, trying to intimidate other candidates, trying to intimidate the electorate. But I think that there will still be a big turnout on the vote. A lot of people want to see change, particularly in this area. They want to see the violence finally tackled. They want to see the years of corruption and impunity tackled. And as a result, the front runner, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's been running on exactly that platform, an anti-corruption platform, looks set to become the next president of Mexico.
The BBC's Will Grant in Mexico City. Coming up, surrogacy is booming in India, but no longer for foreigners. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Couples unable to conceive a child often feel desperate, and that desperation can sometimes drive them to extreme measures. Witness the current case of an alleged illegal surrogacy ring in Cambodia. Police there this week arrested four Cambodian women and one Chinese man and charged them with human trafficking after they uncovered an operation involving 33 pregnant women. Surrogacy was banned in Cambodia 2 years ago, but has continued in the shadows. Bans or restrictions on surrogacy have spread amid ethical challenges. Thailand and Nepal recently shut down surrogacy for foreigners. So did India. For years, India was known as the womb of Asia. But now surrogacy there is for Indians only. This week, our Cross Women's Lives desk has been investigating the global surrogacy industry. Today, Chavi Sachdev reports that India's domestic surrogacy industry is booming, at least for now.
Outside of a maternity ward in the waiting area, a young couple are bent over a phone. A few minutes ago, I'd seen them beckoned by a nurse and ushered in through a closed door. Now, every few moments, they look at each other and smile.
We just had a baby.
Yeah, we got a baby.
Oh, congratulations. May I ask, who delivered the baby?
We have a surrogate.
You had a surrogate baby?
Their newborn girl has been taken to the neonatal intensive care unit, and the parents are about to follow. The birth mother, gestational carrier, is in the ward getting some much-needed sleep. And if my asking who carried the baby seems bizarre, it's not. It's perfectly normal here because I'm at the Akanksha Hospital in Anand, Gujarat. The hospital's founder, Dr. Naina Patel, is the face for assisted reproduction and surrogacy in India. Surrogacy is reported to bring $400 million every year into the Indian economy.
Infertility is not a disease or a sexual disorder. It is a common experience, as common as your friendly uncle's baldness or your cousin's anemia.
Doctors in even the smallest town assist in it, and in a place like Anand, it's big business. Here, fertility clinics not only assist in surrogacy, they also keep a rotating roster of surrogates in all stages of pregnancy right on the premises. Women come from all over the country, and for 9 months they live in a dorm, away from their families, and carry a stranger's child to term. Dr. Patel has assisted thousands of couples in having a baby through surrogacy.
Yeah, it was always my dream to practice infertility and make from patients to parents.
In India, maybe more than other parts of the world, having a child is a big, big part of marriage. For many people who have an arranged marriage, having a male heir is the main reason they get married.
And what could happen to their marriages? Either they live a childless life, or there is a divorce or a second wife sometimes. Or she's totally depressed and sometimes try a suicidal attempt also.
But Dr. Patel didn't create surrogacy here. Since the 90s, couples and single people, gay and straight, had been coming to India to hire surrogates to have their babies. Anyone from anywhere could fly to India, spend about $35,000 and leave with the baby. The industry was poorly regulated. Reports from human rights agencies started to circulate about how the surrogates had no idea what they were agreeing to. They were ill-informed of their rights, and in some cases, they weren't being paid. Dr. Patel's hospital does three levels of counselling, orally and through audiovisual presentation, as many surrogates are illiterate and would not be able to read a contract. Then, in 2015, the government put a stop to all international surrogacy. But the ban on surrogacy is only for foreigners. For young women here, having a baby for an Indian couple is still a good way to make money. In the administrative area of Dr. Patel's hospital, a young woman waits nervously. Sunita is a surrogate. This is her second time. She says the first time she did it, it was so her family could afford a house.
पहली बार तो हमारी परिस्थिति बहुत वो थी क्योंकि हमारे रहने के लिए घर
The first time around, our situation was terrible. A house was makeshift. We had coconut palm fronds for the roof. We needed money.
Her first surrogate baby was implanted back when India still allowed international surrogacy. She was hired for a British couple, and she giggles when she says she had no chance to get attached to the baby. Not only was she counseled all along about handing over the baby, but also the baby was white. She has three children of her own. Her husband is a tailor, and he earns about $60 a month.
So, if you work, you don't have to work. So, you don't have to work.
If I work, this wouldn't be possible. I couldn't collect enough money to do anything. With a lump sum, I can do much more. I have built my house. I'm going to send my children to college.
If Sunita gets pregnant with a baby this time, she'll make $8,000. If she has twins, it'll be $11,000. On her job, it would take her 34 years to save that much money. Here, she gets to relax, watch TV, take vocational classes, hang out with other surrogates. They're looked after. It's easy, she says. But there is a bill in Parliament to ban all commercial surrogacy, even for Indian couples. This means that couples who can have a surrogate baby would have to meet a stringent set of criteria, including how long they've been married and showing proof that they're infertile. Plus, their surrogate has to be a close relative doing it out of pure altruism.
The right to parenting is universal and individual as well. It doesn't matter if you're single, married, divorced, separated, whatever the case be.
That's Rakesh Kumar, a single father from Mumbai who's just had his second child through surrogacy.
So the elder one is 9 months old, and when he was born, the day itself I started the process for the second one.
Right, you couldn't stop at one.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the fear of the bill.
The fear of the bill. The bill that would outlaw commercial surrogacy was a distinct trigger for Kumar, and he's worried that it will create a black market for surrogacy.
I've been watching the surrogates quite closely, and I think the transformation that would have happened to their lives by just this very basic financial support is quite significant versus them having to struggle and make ends meet and, you know, the issues around domestic violence, human trafficking and so on and so forth. And I think all of this will lead to that.
Dr. Patel herself echoes this sentiment. She feels that stakeholders, parents, doctors, surrogates, need to approach the government medical committee and try to reason with them to push for stronger regulations rather than ending surrogacy entirely.
In fact, I feel that India could have become a leader in this whole thing. They could have shown the world that we can do surrogacy in the best possible way for anybody on this earth, but with proper regulations, taking care of the surrogates, the babies born, we'll see that nobody is exploited.
But for now, it looks like India's commercial surrogacy days are numbered. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev, Anand Gujarat, India.
Our Cross Women's Lives team has been fielding comments and questions from listeners this week about the global surrogacy industry, and reporter Allison Herrera will be answering some of those questions next week on the show. But if you want to be part of the conversation, you can add your own experience by going to PRI.org/fertility. We'll be tackling some of the ethical issues surrounding surrogacy next week on The World. I'm Carol Hills. An Italian politician channels Donald Trump on immigration.
Matteo Salvini, the interior minister of Italy, is a very strongly anti-migrant voice, a very powerful voice, and it is noticeable the similarities in his rhetoric when you compare it to President Trump's rhetoric.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. There's a new deal between European leaders on migration. It came after an all-night meeting in Brussels. The agreement aims to restrict the movement of migrants within Europe and establish centers to process asylum requests outside of Europe. British Prime Minister Theresa May says it's a step forward.
We've come to positive conclusions, a lot of them around what the United Kingdom has been encouraging for some time, which is taking more action upstream in countries of origin so that we can ensure that people aren't having to make and aren't making these very dangerous journeys, often travelling many miles, often at the hands of the people smugglers, and making the dangerous trips across the Mediterranean where we still see some people dying.
The new plan comes amid an uptick in asylum seekers risking that trip across the Mediterranean from North Africa and growing pressure from Italy's new government to crack down on immigration. My BBC colleague James Reynolds is covering the story from the Maltese capital, Valletta.
they've done a little bit of what Italy wanted in reinforcing the Libyan Coast Guard. In other words, to try to stop boats from setting off across the Mediterranean from Libya towards Malta and Italy. Secondly, the EU has talked in rather vague language about exploring the creation of migrant centres in Africa itself, so-called disembarkation platforms, which Italy has called for. There's no actual commitment from any countries in North Africa, which of course were not represented at the EU summit. And there is one other point, which is the potential establishment of what are called control centres or migrant holding centres by EU countries. Those would be in Europe itself and carried out on a voluntary basis. But the crucial point lacking from the accord is this. We don't know who those volunteers might be. No one has yet put up their hand. And therefore, I think Italy and Malta, from where I'm speaking, will only be happy once the rather vague language has been transformed into actual tangible commitments. Because we've all seen in the past EU deals about migration fail. There was one I remember reporting on in 2015, a relocation deal. That fell apart in the end.
Yeah, there's so many mentions of the word voluntary in this agreement. I mean, what's concrete about it?
Nothing at the moment, which is the worry potentially for Italy and for Malta that good words on paper, if they rely on the word voluntary, have nothing to stand up behind. The reason that word was put in is that Central and Eastern European states did not want to have anything to do with hosting more migrants. The right-wing and occasionally populist governments in that part of the European Union want to have nothing to do with it. I'm here in Malta. I spend a lot of time in Italy as well. And it's still not clear how these centres would work. If a boat arrives in Italy or in Malta, would everyone there be flown to a different country, to Belgium, the Netherlands, France, or Spain for inspection? How would that work? The language of the agreement is not clear.
Italy basically held this meeting hostage until they dealt with the issue of migration, and they feel like they've been especially burdened by the migrants. Are they pleased with this agreement?
They say they are. The Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, said it shows that Italy is not alone. He signed up to the agreement. Therefore, of course, he now has to try to sell it. But I think on reflection for some of the Italian coalition, this populist coalition, they might be rather worried by the vague language. It's all very well saying there should be a voluntary commitment, but who will be the volunteers?
The number of migrants coming across the Mediterranean from Libya has dropped precipitously in the past year or so. What's been behind that drop in migrants?
A deal between Italy and Libya that was arranged by the previous Italian government, a centre-left government. It reached a deal by which it would give support and training to the Libyan Coast Guard so that when boats set off from the Libyan coast, instead of carrying on towards the Mediterranean and Malta and Italy, the Libyan Coast Guard would stop those boats. And that has resulted in a 70 to 80% drop in traffic across the Mediterranean on that dangerous route. The new Italian government inherited that policy, but has decided that it doesn't even want to live with that drop. It wants to get the number down to zero.
So despite this drop, migration is still just this hot issue within the EU.
It is. And I was in Catania, one of the main ports of Sicily the other day, and my colleagues and I were speaking to people, and about a dozen people, I'd say about 10 of whom, were vociferously anti-migrants. They said they were fed up. They said that they wanted help from other countries, that Italy should not be left on its own. Now, of course, one can put it to them that migration is down 70 to 80% over the last 12 months. But what they would reply to that is they're still dealing with the cumulative effect of several years of what, from their point of view, was unchecked migration.
Does the approach by Donald Trump and his kind of crackdown on migration here and crackdown on borders, does that affect the debate over migration within Europe?
I'm pretty sure that it does. Matteo Salvini, the interior minister of Italy, is a very strongly anti-migrant voice, a very powerful voice, and it is noticeable the similarities in his rhetoric when you compare it to President Trump's rhetoric. Matteo Salvini even has extended beyond migration. The other day he talked about trying to conduct a partial census of the Roma itinerant community in Italy, and then he said, unfortunately, those with Italian citizenship would be allowed to stay, something which worried a lot of people in Italy, feeling that it was perhaps a reminder of a 1930s past that hadn't been entirely buried.
Now, you're in Valletta, Malta, and that's an interesting place to be because it's where this migrant ship, the Lifeline ship, it was run by a German charity, it was finally allowed to dock there after being rejected by several countries. What's happened to the migrants from that ship?
They've been sent to a holding center called Marsa, which I went and had a look at a little earlier. The migrants, we were about separated from them for about 40 or 50 meters on the other side of a rather dirty canal. They were calm. They were wearing new orange T-shirts and other clothes that had been given to them. They were just standing on a terrace, taking in their first full day on solid ground. And some of them carried papers in their hands. Clearly, the process of identifying them and sifting through their asylum claims has begun. We know there were three babies on board that ship. They'd been taken to hospital for preliminary examination, but we haven't been told that they were to stay there. And essentially, these more than 200 migrants will now begin the process of seeing which European countries they will be taken to. Around eight countries have so far put up their hands and said, we'll take them. Those eight countries may be the beginnings of those volunteers that we've talked about for the larger deal.
But those 200 will definitely be placed somewhere in Europe?
What we understand is that those 200 will be given the chance to be placed in those other countries in Europe. Some countries have only pledged to take about 20 or 25, but those countries, a lot of them in Western Europe and in Portugal and Southern Europe, say that they still have to carry out asylum checks. They want to check who there are. They want to check what kind of record they might have.
Doctors Without Borders Medical Charity, they've branded this new EU deal inhumane. Is there any validity to that?
I think their point will be that Libyan coast guards may not treat people the way that the EU would hope people to be treated, and that returning migrants to detention centres in North Africa would subject them to conditions which the EU should not be proud of.
The BBC's James Reynolds speaking to us from Malta. Thanks a lot, James.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
As we just heard from James, Italy's new government wants to cut migration into their country to zero. As part of that policy, the country's interior minister has vowed to close Italy's ports to all foreign ships rescuing migrants on the Mediterranean. The world's Rich Hall has been reporting on the migrant crisis in the region. Last year, he traveled on one of those rescue ships for our Global Post Investigations Unit. And since then, there's been a twist to the story of that ship.
That's right. So it was about this time last year that I was out in the Mediterranean Sea with one of these rescue ships. And I was there to document these rescue missions and see what they were like and see where the migrants are coming from.
All stations. There are approximately 130 people on board the first rubber boat.
And then subsequently something very strange came out about the boat that I was on. It turned out that there was an undercover agent, a spy working for the Italian police on board the ship that I was on.
So at the time you were on the ship, was there any kind of talk? Was there any suspicion that there was a spy on board?
No, we had absolutely no idea. So I'll just explain what the situation was out there on the ship. So you had the Save the Children crew, and then you had this Italian security team that was working with Save the Children. And the security team would basically help with the rescues and then do crowd control when the migrants were on board. The aid workers considered themselves part of one big team. But these security workers, these Italian security workers, they were feeding information back to the police. And they helped bring an undercover agent working for the Italian police on board. This undercover operation was made possible by a man called Christian Ricci. He was the head of that security team. Again, considered a friend by these aid workers. They worked together in this really stressful and chaotic environment. No one had any idea at the time. And it only became public when the authorities seized another rescue ship based on the spying that they'd done from the Save the Children ship. And so when they seized, impounded this other ship, this undercover operation on board the boat that I was on was made public.
So how did you hear about it? Were you like reading a newspaper or reading online and you read this and you went, whoa?
Yeah, it was exactly one of those moments. I saw it online and I thought, hold on a minute, was this a ship that I was on? And I started calling all the aid workers who I was on the ship with, and they were just as bemused as me. And in fact, they had more of a reason to be surprised because they lived alongside these people on this boat, and they were angry.
So I understand you actually tracked this guy down, Christian Ricci.
Hey, Christian. How are you?
Fine.
Good to see you.
And what did he say?
That's right. I didn't think he would talk to me, to be honest. I thought he'd want to go and hide away. But it was interesting. I wanted to find out his motivations for doing this. Because the confusing thing about this was that he was there. He was saving people from the sea. He was doing it. He was saving lives. and he was affected by it. He'd broken down crying after some of these rescues. So I wanted to know why he would undermine them like this.
And what did he say?
His basic argument was that the charities don't distinguish between economic migrants and actual refugees. He saw that as a problem, and he wanted to monitor these people more and investigate who was coming onto their boats.
They make a great job because they save life, but they don't make different from criminal and other people. This is the problem.
His whole argument was they should be doing more to help the police monitor the people that were coming onto the boats and save the children and the other rescuers. Their position was, we're not the police. We're out here to save lives, and we can't be focusing on doing their job for them. We'll cooperate with them, but we're not going to do their job for them.
Rich, did you feel persuaded by Christian Ricci's explanation? Do you think he was genuinely moved by these rescues, but still sort of troubled by certain aspects of it?
I do, yeah. I think ultimately he's quite a patriotic man. He was in the Navy before he was doing these missions. I did ask him kind of how did you feel about lying to the people or deceiving the people you worked so closely alongside with? And this is what he told me.
Did you feel like you were being dishonest with your friends on the ship?
No, because when I started, I decided to follow my cautions.
What would you say to them?
I think that I follow my cautions. Yeah, only this.
I think he thought he was doing the right thing because he thought he saw something going on.
What are you referring to?
They thought that the charities were collaborating with human traffickers. They thought that they were communicating with them and helping them in some ways.
That just sounds nutty. What kind of collusion were they suggesting?
So it could be small things. For instance, one of the main allegations was that once they'd unloaded one of these little dinghies that the migrants travel on, once they'd taken the migrants off them onto their ship, they then carried this little dinghy, dragged it along the water back towards Libya so the people smugglers could fill it back up again. And that was what they thought they saw. The NGOs and the charities deny doing this. They said they carried it in the other direction. It's small things like that that this undercover agent saw and perhaps thought he saw one thing and the NGOs, the charities say it was another thing.
Rich, do you get the sense that the Italian government is helping to kind of push these rumors of conspiracy between the rescue boats and Libya? Does it serve a political end, or am I being too harsh?
Well, it's interesting because if you go back to last year and even before that, this narrative that these rescue missions were collaborating with smugglers, it came from people like Matteo Salvini, who is now the Interior Minister. He was the leader of this far-right Liga party. This narrative came from them originally. And back then, they were just a party trying to win votes and get into government. Today, he's the Interior Minister. So today, he is the government. And it's gone from this right-wing narrative to official Italian policy.
Correspondent Rich Hall with our Global Post Investigations Unit. We've got a lot more of his reporting on that story at PRI.org. Good news is always welcome here at The World. And on Monday, it's a good news story from China. Two old friends meet after a long time apart. Matter of fact, they last saw each other when they were schoolboys, about to be sent to the countryside to do hard labor during China's Cultural Revolution. On Monday, we'll hear how they both escaped separately to Hong Kong, but had no idea the other was even alive until now.
They said, yeah, something like, oh, finally, I got you. They tried to compare each other height, because obviously when they got separated, they were both still a child, but now they met a completely new guy.
An unexpected reunion, that's on Monday. It's on to the knockout stage for the Men's Soccer World Cup tournament in Russia. 16 teams remain. Tomorrow, France faces off against Argentina, both former champions. 20 years ago, France defeated Brazil, and it was seen as a defining moment for the country, not just for sports. For many, it heralded a new era of racial harmony. But it didn't quite turn out that way. Adeline Sear has the story.
When France won its first and only World Cup on July 12, 1998,
The nation erupted in delirium. More than a million people descended on the Champs-Élysées to celebrate. Alban Traquet is a reporter for France's leading sports daily, L'Équipe. He says it was a historic moment for the country.
The two major moments of collective euphoria in terms of crowds on the street are the liberation of Paris in 1944 and the World Cup victory in 1998.
A new documentary looks back at the 20 years since the win that made all of France proud. It features interviews with players from that legendary team, including defender Lilian Thuram, who has this burning question.
La victoire de la Coupe du Monde a été un moment essentiel dans le questionnement.
The World Cup victory was a defining moment for questioning what we are as French people, he says. The French team was composed of players of different colors and different religions. Can we also accept this in our society outside of sports? Thuram was one of several black players on the team. In addition, there was the iconic Zinedine Zidane, the French player of Algerian descent. People nicknamed the team Black Blanc Beurre, white, black, and Arab, a play on the French flag's colors, blue, white, and red. Many politicians would parade the team's image as a shining example of a successful, multicultural France.
Moi, je me rappelle le lendemain, le 13 juillet, de femmes qui...
Reporter Alban Traquet remembers that the day after the victory, he saw two women carrying a flag bearing both French and Algerian national colors. He says it displayed a spirit of cultural togetherness, but it didn't last. In fact, 4 years later, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the far-right leader of the National Front, stunned France by advancing to the second round of the presidential election. He didn't win, but in the past, he had famously criticized the French team for including players from, quote, foreign countries.
Pour ma part, j'étais assez sceptique, contrairement aux gens.
Louis-Georges Tin says he was always skeptical of this idea of a multiracial team somehow bringing France together. Tin is with the group CRAN, a coalition of black associations. He says even though today's national team includes a more diverse roster of players than in 1998, the racism that you saw 20 years ago still persists, especially in sports.
Avec Yannick Noah, le sportif de tennis, par exemple.
It was the case with tennis champion Yannick Noah, for example, he says. When he won, it was France won. And when he lost, it was the Cameroonian lost again. It happens all the time, including in soccer and its national team. When the Black Blanc Beurre team won, it was a win for France. And when they lost, it was, there are too many blacks in the French team. Even worse, says Stein, is when soccer players are the target of racial slurs.
Aujourd'hui en France, lorsque des joueurs noirs interviennent sur le stade,
today in France, when black players enter the stadium, you can often hear some fans making monkey noises, he says. There have even been cases where a player got sanctioned instead of the offenders when he complained to the referee. Just last month, there was a violent incident in Corsica. When a soccer team from Le Havre arrived to play a game, their bus was attacked by local fans who threw rocks and chanted racist insults. There were more insults during the game. France's Professional Soccer League says it's investigating. Reporter Alban Traquet says it's true the Black Blanc Beurre spirit of 1998 didn't lead to significant progress on racial attitudes, but he says some things have changed. He says the team inspired many talented young players from disadvantaged backgrounds to pursue the sport professionally.
Il y a une chose qui est sûre, comme le football, le sport le plus populaire.
What is certain is that soccer is one of the most popular sports today and that it's inclusive. For kids in training clubs, they learn that the best members play. It's obvious today when you see that we have a very diverse French national team and it's the best players who are in it.
For the world, Aline Cyr, Paris.
We're at the halfway mark of the World Cup in Russia right now, and after 2 weeks of competition, there are 16 teams left to fight for the cup. The knockout stage of the competition begins tomorrow with France facing Argentina and Uruguay squaring off with Portugal. Should be two nail-biting matches. To catch us up on the competition, we have the world's soccer superfan, William Troop, here in the studio.
Hey, Carol.
Hey, William. What have been the highlights so far for you?
Well, halfway through this tournament, there's been a lot of drama. We talked a few days ago on the show about the reigning World Cup champions, Germany, being eliminated to everyone's surprise. They didn't look so good. Mexico beat them. That was another highlight, early highlight of this tournament. Now Mexico is, you know, everybody's waiting to see, are they the good Mexico that beat Germany or the not so good Mexico that lost to Sweden? Argentina survived by the skin of its teeth. The team played really some terrible games, lost against Croatia 3-0, but made it through somehow. Now we're getting into the part of the tournament where you can't lose anymore. It's a knockout stage. It's do or die.
So, sudden death.
Yeah.
So, William, in this knockout stage, what are you going to be looking for?
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing teams like Belgium and Colombia in the knockout stages because they have shown some really quality, fun-to-watch, attacking soccer that anybody can watch. You don't have to be a super fan like, I don't know, myself.
Like you.
To enjoy those games. I'm hoping to see them progress through the tournament. That would be really, really nice. And I'm hoping that some team that has not won the World Cup makes a long run here and wins for the first time. No disrespect Brazil, no disrespect Argentina, but I would be thrilled if some team like Colombia or Belgium won this time.
That's the world's soccer expert, William Troop. Thanks, William.
You're welcome, Carol.
That's our show for this Friday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Our show comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We're online 24/7 over at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills, wishing you all a great weekend. Back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.